We're talking about raising goats here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Wisconsin, we lead the nation in milking goats with 72,000 head. That's 2019 data from the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. So with the exception of a few small local markets, all goat milk produced here is made into cheese. Are you thinking about raising goats? What questions do you have about getting started? What breeds are you curious about? We're at 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is with us for the hour, and we're going to start with her passion for goats. She is vice president of the Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association. Her family has been raising dairy goats since 1970, and they now run a farm in southeastern Minnesota. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me back. I'm very happy to be here.
And goats are just so darn cute, aren't they? I mean, they're just, they're lovable.
They are. They are. They have a lot of personality, and they win a lot of converts just on that alone, I think.
And
so, yeah.
You got the privilege of growing up with goats and just really getting to know them as a kid.
Right. My parents, they got their first goats about a decade before I was born. And, I have a lot of fond memories of, you know, being out in the kid barn, especially, you know, the kids are a lot of fun and fairly, safe to have around small children too. And so doing that, you know, I think I milked my first goat when I was about 5 or 6 years old. We've always milked by hand too, our family has. And so, that is a way to really connect with an animal, obviously, if you're milking them twice a day. And then when I was a little older, you know, I was really involved in 4-H, and goats are very popular as both 4-H or FFA projects throughout Wisconsin, throughout Minnesota as well, and the upper Midwest.
Is that because it's easier for kids, our kids, to handle them or to work with them?
Right. I think that's a big part of it. You know, they aren't nearly as imposing an animal, say, as a cow or even a horse. Goats are a lot more inexpensive as a project as well as compared to, say, a horse. And again, they're just really easy to handle. You can start, a young child can start with a dairy goat project when that goat is a small kid, and, you know, continue to work with that animal, you know, up through, a goat's lifespan. Generally, they can live to be up to, you know, 10, 11 years old. So it's a wonderful project to have, you know, for a child. And now too, in terms of dairy goats in particular, you have the Nigerian dwarf breed, which is a miniature breed, which has gotten to be very popular across the country. And, you know, for small children, you know, the Nigerian dwarf is also a very popular breed because they are so easy to handle. But I also mentioned, my expertise is in the area of dairy goats, but you also have meat goat breeds that are very popular as well, sort of akin to beef cattle, where you have those animals are primarily, you know, they become sort of a terminal project for that child to work with, like a hog would be, essentially. Boar goats and meat goats, goat meat has gotten to be a lot more popular to eat as well. And we have, I know a lot of commercial producers for the excess kids and buck kids especially. There's a huge market, particularly in Chicago, for goat meat, right? So there's an outlet there for that meat as well. And so.
We're learning about raising dairy goats, goat meat, with Anna Thompson-Hodgick. She's vice president of the Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association. Do you eat goat cheese or other goat products? What do you enjoy about them? Have you tried dairy goat products but decided it wasn't for you? Are you a goat farmer? What do you think about raising them? Join in 800-642-1234. Anna, in what ways has the coronavirus affected dairy producers and people who are raising goats?
So an interesting thing that's kind of happening is there's a number of effects. So I haven't seen a huge effect on just outright commercial producers, that is, producers that are selling their milk, to a co-op. I think, or a global company, our largest buyer of goat milk in Wisconsin is Saputo, which is actually a Canadian company. And I think that demand generally has stayed pretty stable. The folks that are really struggling more are those farmstead producers, so folks that are milking their animals, but then also producing their own product and selling that product to farmers markets direct to consumer. Because, of course, it's harder to get to farmers markets now. We still have some here, but it's just a little more challenging right now. Those producers have had to get a little more creative in reaching their consumers. And I have a number of friends across the country who are just trying to be a little more creative, showing a little more ingenuity in trying to reach their consumers. So, for example, I have friends in Tennessee who have a farmstead dairy goat creamery operation, and that's Tennessee. So they don't have quite as many of the as strict stay-at-home or orders as some of the other states do, but they've opened their farm up to agritourism, and they'll invite folks to come to the farm and have sort of kid cuddling days and have kind of a cheese board days. So they come, families are invited to come picnic at the farm, have a purchase a cheese board, and they can safely socially distance that way and kind of connect to the land as well. And that's been one of the more creative solutions that some friends of mine have done. And then that's also driven innovation. There are a number of creameries that are making cheeses that they've never made before because they have more time to kind of do research and development. Different kinds of cheeses that they think might appeal to consumers. But at the same time, they have to really focus on those consumers because the restaurants right now are just not purchasing that cheese because they aren't open to the public. So it's it, one in one area, it is really driving innovation in order to reach the direct to consumer market more.
Well, speaking of innovation, I learned about the city of Madison recently rented a herd of 40 goats to munch on invasive plants in two of the city parks. And they said that that was they're, overgrown with invasive. The goats are better than spraying herbicide. What do you think of that approach?
Yeah, no, that is something that has been done for quite a while, especially out west. California has really used a lot of goats out there to really cut down on underbrush to mitigate, wildfires. And I think that's great. I think it's a fairly low cost option, and the goats are a lot gentler on the landscape than, as you said, the chemicals in the environment, and they're kind of popular as well. If someone is going to the park and they end up seeing a whole herd of goats, well, that can be kind of exciting and different, right? But yeah, they are just it's a nice kind of low impact on the environment method to control these invasive species, buckthorn, honeysuckle, those sorts of plants.
We're
So, yeah.
talking about raising goats with Anna Thompson Hodgick and how the pandemic affects dairy goat producers. What questions do you have about goats? Do you show your goats or produce products from their milk? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute. More on goats here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the joys of raising goats. Prospective goat farmers must determine where their billies, does, and or their wethers, the neutered males are called wethers, I learned, where are they going to live? And then potentially, where are the kids going to live? And if you have goats taking up residence, where will you get your hay and your grain? Have you lined up a vet who will tend to your goats? What happens if you want to take a vacation from milking? Have you researched breeds? Let's talk about the details of goat farming. 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is Vice President of the Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association, and she stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Tiffany is here from Madison. Hi, Tiffany.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good. What about goats in your life?
So I have never farmed goats. We've visited them. But I need to know about fainting goats. Talk to me about them. Why do they faint?
Oh, well, so fainting goats are one particular kind of subset of goats. They're not dairy goats. Fainting goats are the term is myotonic breed, and what fainting actually is kind of a genetic defect, actually. And so they have a little bit of a genetic defect that, of course, when they are surprised or shocked in some way, they kind of keel over and faint, and then it's a few seconds, 30 seconds, they'll pop right back up again. I don't have a lot of experience myself with fainting goats, but you know, they're cute. You know, they are kind of interesting little companion animals. The term is myotonic. And it is ultimately just a kind of a genetic defect that they, and it, so how they've survived all these years, hundreds of years, thousands of years with that defect is a mystery to me, frankly. But they are an interesting little subset of the of goat species for sure.
Tiffany, Tiffany, where did you see them?
Well, I've seen them like on TV and everything. I mean, we've visited goats at like local farms and barnyards and everything, but just on TV, I can't help but crack up when all of a sudden one gets startled because you hear them go, bah! And then they get startled and all of a sudden it's like statue and they just topple over.
And all right, right. Yeah,
And it's so sad because they're like just so stiff arm and you're like, oh my gosh, are they okay? And then they get back up like nothing ever happened and then you're like, oh my gosh.
Well, they are. That is a normal thing for that to happen for that particular subset of the species. It's just a funny quirk of nature, you might say. Ultimately,
Tiffany, thank you so much for asking about it. As on the topic of breeds, Anna, you had mentioned the Nigerian dwarf breed being very popular. What are some of the other breeds that you find in Wisconsin?
So the other sort of for dairy breeds, we have our standard breeds. We have what we call our kind of our Swiss collection of breeds. So that would be the Saanen, the all white breed. They are very popular at commercial dairies because they just really produce a lot of milk and they are easy keepers. Saanens are. We have French Alpines or American Alpines that can be any color. They also originated over in France, and they are particularly popular, of course, in France, but they are quite popular in the United States. The Toggenburg breed is the oldest imported breed to the United States. The first Toggenburgs were imported in the early 1900s, and they hail from Switzerland, and the Toggenburg, that name even is named after the Toggenburg Valley in Switzerland. We have Oberhasli's,
you raise Toggenbergs, is that right?
That's right. My family raises Toggenbergs and Alpines. So one of my dreams, ultimately, when we can travel overseas again, is to go to Switzerland and to go to the Toggenburg Valley where my goats come from. I would love to do that someday. Mm-hmm. Oberhasli's is another popular breed that is another Swiss breed. Oberhasli too is a Swiss a Swiss name. And then the Nubian. The Nubian has the long floppy ears, and they are quite popular. The kids in particular are really cute when they're all ears, essentially. And that breed actually is originally from Africa. And Nubians are noted for high butterfat content. They aren't quite as much of the producer in terms of the production of the amount of milk, but they have a really high protein and butterfat content. So their milk is particularly good for cheese making. And then they also do very well in warmer climates too. So you see a lot of Nubians, you see certainly a lot of Nubians in the Midwest, but there are Nubians also. They do particularly well in places like Texas, the Deep South. And again, the Nubian breed is, again, noted for its high protein content. So you see a lot of Nubians at commercial dairies, and their milk is very good for cheese making. So
we're learning about raising dairy goats with Anna Thompson Hodgick. She is with the Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association. Your questions about goats, any and all, 800-642-1234. So Anna, let's plan here. So what if we want to raise a goat? What are some of the first steps we need to think about in order to bring that goat into our family?
Okay, good question. So dairy goats are herd animals. So the issue with that then is you can't just have one. They'll be really lonely if you have just one. So you always want to get at least one and a buddy for it. So you can't just have one. You have to have two in order to have them, kind of thrive and be happy. The next step, of course, is to make sure that you have adequate shelter. You can't just, as much as the goats look cute out there grazing in the parklands, they go home at night. They go home to a shelter, to a barn. So it's important to make sure you have that kind of setup. And there are actually wonderful resources now online. There's even there's a group on Facebook called, kind of Goat Barns and Shelters, where you can go and you can look and see all the different kinds of shelters people build for their goats. But that's really important. And then to make sure you have adequate fencing too. Goats are escape artists. And so so that's important. You need to have electric fence actually works very well and is a good kind of cheap option. But, around in and around your barn to make sure you have good quality gates, wooden fencing. Our family uses hog paneling, which is fairly inexpensive, not all through our farm, but certain parts of our barn. And you can purchase that at any major sort of store like Menards or Home Depot, those sorts of, or any livestock show, store too. So fencing, adequate shelter is really important. And then I would say maybe the third pillar of that is making sure you have a good feed source. If you want to have dairy goats or goats, any kind of goats, make sure you can develop relationships with your local grain elevator, have a hay source. And then our goats generally actually don't love pasture. Our goats are kind of spoiled in that way. but you have, if you have a good amount of pasture that your goats can browse onto, that's good too. And to make sure you have enough room and land for your animals is important as well. So,
how often do the goats need to see a vet, or what is the vet relationship like?
Okay, so that's also, that's an important component to you. Make sure you have a good and, say, large animal vet in your area. Large animal veterinarians, it's not as profitable a lot of times and so you have a lot more small vets today than we used to have. And, we see our vet a few times a year, primarily to make sure if we're going to be going to a show or we're going to be selling animals, we usually need a health certificate that has to be certified by a veterinarian. But we also, there are always emergency situations that pop up, generally during kidding season on the spring, which is an exciting time when baby goats are born. But every so often, goats can get into trouble when they're having babies. And so you need to be able to call a vet out on a kind of a moment's notice if something maybe goes wrong with kidding. because goats are escape artists too, they can sometimes, you know, get themselves into sticky situations, get their head caught or break a leg, right? And, that's unfortunate when that happens. But if you do have a vet that you trust, that you're in contact with regularly, that's the kind of thing that you would really want to rely on a vet for. And goats can be susceptible to things like parasites. I think I had mentioned that before when I was on here. And there's a condition called coccidia, which can be really devastating, particularly to kids in the spring and summer months. And so, again, working with a vet, working out, a plan to prevent those sorts of diseases is just really important.
Yeah, so there's a lot of planning that goes into making right. sure you're providing a good home for those new goats.
Right.
We have Anna Thompson-Hodgick for the hour, and now we're going to switch gears on her expertise from goats to movies. She's also a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater teaching courses on film. How is your family experiencing movies differently because of the pandemic? Are you watching more movies at home? How is the pandemic changing the way you consume films? And what about the content? Are you exploring a specific genre? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to talk about the film industry right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the film industry now and what to watch. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hollywood studios and unions, they asked Congress this week to jumpstart their battered entertainment industry with a legislative package that includes hiring incentives, federal insurance, and more expensing of production costs. Variety is reporting there's only a minimal amount of production underway due to COVID-19, partly due to the lack of available insurance. So the industry is saying they can't buy insurance to cover losses on set from communicable diseases. So in the absence of summer blockbusters, what movies are you watching? Will you return to movie theaters? What do you think of Netflix's Black Lives Matter collection? We're at 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is with us, still teaching film at UW-Whitewater. So Anna, switching gears from goats to film, how is the pandemic affecting what you're watching these days?
Yeah, so personally, I'm kind of using these months to sort of get caught up on movies I've missed, maybe classics that, movies I've always had sort of meant to, get watched and haven't had a chance to. For me, I'm always kind of watching films with an eye towards, well, maybe I'll use that for a class. And one course I teach is gender in film. And so I'm trying, and then, particularly this last month with all of the protests and the BLM activity, thinking too about how I can continually sort of diversify what I'm teaching to my students. One of the most fascinating documentaries that I watched this last month was a documentary all about Mae West that premiered on PBS. And so it, nothing too, you didn't even have to have cable really or a streaming service to watch this film. But it was fascinating in terms of, it was a lengthy documentary kind of positioning a classic film star, Mae West, from the 1930s and connecting her image and her life to the gender politics of today. And, that's one way I think we can use a lot of this time when movie theaters are closed is to, seek out these different sorts of stories, again, more innovative stories on our streaming platforms or on even network television, PBS, to tell stories in different ways. And that documentary on Mae West, it was called American Masters, and it was really well done.
Some of the things on your list, it makes sense now. I mean, powerful women characters. You mentioned what happened, Miss Simone, and that's the 2015 biopic. What do you think of that?
That was excellent too. And that film, you know, that's about, again, the jazz singer Nina Simone, kind of tracing her career, you know, from the 1950s all the way up until the early 1990s. And you know, someone that just was such a powerful voice for change and someone that was really ahead of her time in terms of thinking about, you know, someone that she always kind of fought for equality, and was really, you know, fighting that fight upstream, but very much ahead of her time. Mm-hmm. And the music is fantastic in a documentary like that. The footage, there's minimal narration. I mean, there's a lot of her voice and the people around her, but there's no sort of like omission narrator. The filmmaker kind of gets out of the way and just lets the footage of Simone's performances, of her various stances, in civil rights, do the talking in that film.
So really, this portrait of both the musician and the activist, and really, you know, how her life as a Black woman in America, her life would be constrained by racism.
Exactly. Yep. It's a great film. And especially if you are looking to just really increase your knowledge about civil rights activism, I can't recommend that documentary enough.
Well, another strong woman character, very strong, Michelle McNamara in I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is now streaming on HBO. And this is a documentary series.
Yes, it's a docu-series. And Michelle McNamara was someone that, you know, she was had kind of was a amateur, starting out as amateur, but just kind of overtook her life. The hunt for the Golden State Killer, which he was just in the news this week. I think he finally pled guilty. She just kind of dedicated her life to victim advocacy, the victims of the Golden State Killer. And there was this whole network of folks that were sort of helping in this effort to figure out who he was, who the Golden State Killer was. And Michelle McNamara was someone that, you know, kind of chronicled her efforts and worked with sort of police as well. And then again, eventually, unfortunately, it kind of took over her life, and she actually ended up losing her life as a result of this kind of all sort of enveloping effort to track the Golden State Killer down. McNamara was married to the comedian Patton Oswalt, and so he kind of also chronicled his grief when she died so young. She was only 46 when she died, and he and the filmmaker worked together to sort of bring this docuseries to life, kind of going back through her notes, her diaries. And her voice is really prioritized in this film, but also the victims' voices are prioritized in the film as well. And that was one thing that, you know, in true crime, as a genre is so often critiqued because it kind of sensationalizes, obviously, the crime and the committer of a crime, obviously. And sometimes those victim voices are lost. And one thing I've read about this docuseries is that here you have the victims, really, their stories are not lost. They are very much the central
front
part
and
of the
center.
Story. Front and center, right. But McNamara, you have an actress, the actress Amy Ryan, I believe her name is reading McNamara's words, and that kind of acts as a sort of narration for the docuseries, along, again, with the interviews of victims and their families as well.
We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick. She's a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaching courses on film, and we're talking about the industry and what to watch. What are some of your favorite movies of all time? What are you watching now? How is your family experiencing movies differently due to the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. Anna, another film you have an eye on is Jon Stewart's Irresistible, which is set in the fictional Deer Lock in Wisconsin. It's a political satire. What do you say? What do you have to say about that?
So, yeah, so, you know, this is a film that, again, Jon Stewart wrote, and I think he directed it too. And you know, there was a lot of anticipation for this film. And, you know, of course, it looks a lot of fun, certainly set in kind of rural Wisconsin. Unfortunately, the reviews have not been the best. And again, I think the film suffers from an unfortunate kind of moment of bad timing in that, you know, it just kind of seems a bit dated considering everything that's happened right in the last 3 to 4 months. And so the other issue that some reviewers have pointed out is that there aren't really any actors of color in the cast. And so, you know, that's too, just again, kind of, you know, something that, you know, that filmmaking, that, you know, the industry is really taking a much harder stance on these days. Right. That being said, you know, certainly there are some really good actors in the film. Chris Cooper, who is a great character actor that I love, kind of plays this kind of ex-military / dairy farmer person, that kind of person that is kind of plucked from obscurity by Steve Carell, who plays a sort of political operative and is, you know, kind of overnight turned in, you know, this little mayoral race kind of blows up into this huge, huge deal, essentially. But, you know, again, the other side of this is that the film does sort of traffic in these kind of small town regional stereotypes, and critics have kind of have laid into the film for some of those reasons.
There are lots and lots of cows in it.
There are. Yeah. Yeah.
But Jon Stewart was saying, you know, it really is about corruption and campaign finance, which are topics that he's interested in talking about, and, you know, breaking down really complex subjects and making these comical sequences out of them to help better understand what it's about.
Right. And of course, that is certainly still a very timely issue in politics, right? And it is, I think, in a way, can sort of offer relief for laughing at the political process, which has obviously gotten to be so polarized, right? And so problematic, right? As we hit, come up soon here to another election later this fall. And so in that regard, I think, you know, I think the film will certainly find an audience. It just may not be maybe as large an audience had it gotten better reviews. So, yeah.
And you know, just being the appeal for us of being set in Wisconsin, we still want to check it out,
right?
Because,
right,
you know,
yeah.
The set is apparently us as
right,
a swing
right.
state.
right, for sure.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick is a senior lecturer on film at UW-Whitewater, and we're talking about the film industry. We're looking at films that she's watching. So what are you watching? There's still time to talk about movies and how you think the film industry will change after the pandemic. Are your tastes changing in film? What are you watching? We're at 800-642-1234. Are you watching more Netflix? Have you checked out the Black Lives Matter collection? Have you opened up interest into new genres during this time of staying at home? Will you ever return to a movie theater? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Anna Thompson-Hodgick right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Productions have been shut down for months across TV and film. The LA Times reports more than 100,000 entertainment industry workers have lost their jobs as box office revenues have sunk to virtually zero. Will you return to theaters? At home now, what are you watching? What recent movie is still on your mind? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Film lecturer Anna Thompson-Hodgick stays with us. So, Anna, how likely are movie theaters to come back here during the pandemic? What's going on with movie theaters?
So the biggest news was AMC. You know, they had that theater chain. They had announced that they were not going to require masks, and then they because they didn't want to get into the political fray, but then they reversed course and have since said that they are going to require masks. And I think the latest I heard was that they are going to be reopening in mid-July. Now, of course, you know, that may change, and it also may be a regional consideration. You know, in places like Florida or Arizona, maybe those theaters will stay closed. Maybe in states like, you know, Wyoming and Montana, where the cases aren't as numerous, maybe they'll be open. And it's hard to say. And I think that that's one challenge that particularly these national chains are having is, you know, if we're going to reopen, are we going to reopen only in certain states, or are we going to just go forward and open everywhere? Interestingly, you know, there's these smaller independent theaters. They may not, some of them may be able to weather this all right, but others are closing. The little town of Stoughton, Wisconsin, where I, when I first moved to Wisconsin, my husband and I lived there. They recently announced they closed their theater back in April. And that was really sad to hear because that little theater in Stoughton is right on Main Street. You know, it kind of doubled as a pizza parlor and ice cream shop as well. And so I do fear for some of these smaller independent cinemas. On the other hand, you have an uptick now in drive-in movie theaters. Drive-in theaters kind of filling that gap. There's a great little drive-in movie theater on the way to Jefferson, Wisconsin, in our listening area, and that I think I don't think they added too many weekends. Kind of had more limited schedule, but if they had wanted to, they could probably show a movie every single weekend and be sold out right now. So it's interesting what the pandemic has brought in terms of kind of winners and losers. I think it's the Madison Mallards that have kind of repurposed their ball field into drive-in movie theater night as well, right? So it's just different, you know, again,
there's that innovation again.
Innovation, exactly, right. People trying to get innovative in terms of how we can enjoy sort of familiar entertainment, right?
So as we start to wrap up here, even if theaters do open back up in July sometime this month, can you believe it's July, but, right. You know, what will Hollywood have to offer? What could be released?
So, I mean, there are a bunch of movies, you know, that these big summer blockbusters that were going to be coming out this fall. A lot of them have moved back their release dates. So it seems like a lifetime ago, but back in early March, you had Daniel Craig, you know, the star of, you know, the James Bond franchise right now, you know, doing promotional work for No Time to Die. Well, that the latest Bond entry. Well, that release now has been moved all the way back to November. And you have other movies like The Wonder Woman 1984, The Top Gun update with, you know, good old Tom Cruise. These major kind of blockbuster movies that just would be best seen, obviously, in a theater. Those releases have all been moved to the fall.
Well,
that being said,
yeah, so there's a bit of pent-up demand there as to when things can be released.
Right. Now, you know, on the other hand, you have some movies that have gone direct to video. The King of Staten Island, which was a film that got really stellar reviews with Pete Davidson, directed by Judd Apatow, that went right to kind of direct to video release, and I think has done fairly well on various streaming platforms. But you do have to pay to see those movies quite a bit. So though the movie like that would cost you about $20, $25 to stream, because they are, you know, the studio is trying to get back at least some of the revenue, right?
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. right. Thank you.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick is vice president of the Wisconsin Dairy Goat Association, where he spent half the hour, also a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater and teaches courses on film. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition involving fish.
People have been fishing the Mississippi River for about 1,000 years. It's a tradition that's passed down through families for survival and recreation. Mike Valley is part of that tradition and one of the last people to still make a living as a commercial fisherman on the upper Mississippi. And when he gets his catch, he often smokes it. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on Valley's boat to learn more about his smoked fish and his love of the river.
There are few fishermen like Mike Valley left on the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art. It's a dying art. Like sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley is a third-generation fisherman. The work is in his blood. He's owned Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien since the 1980s. He grew up hunting, trapping, clamming, and working with his father. His dad also had a shop on the river and sold his fish to markets in Chicago, New York, and Boston. But as the fishing industry changed, Valley knew the only way he was going to survive was by forging his own path. Sell quality, fresh fish and products that you can't find anywhere else.
I've always said, you'll never have anyone come into my shop and then leave and then go home and tell all their friends and their relatives, this guy had beef jerky. Or, oh my God, he had Colby cheese. No, he had snapping turtle jerky, he had alligator jerky, catfish bologna, the weird things.
Valley is particular. Years of fishing and smoking his catch have taught him that you can't cut corners if you want to stand out. Even though he's caught millions of pounds of fish, the novelty hasn't worn off.
I still really, truly enjoy catching fish. The cleaning, not so much. But that's part of the job. Everybody that I take with me always, they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. This is really great. And then you get back and they go, see ya.
So. Valley cleans the fish, typically catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon, up to 4 times. Then he brines it for at least half a day. Details matter. Not all fish are the same, and they shouldn't be treated the same, he says. The thicker the fish, the more salt you're going to need. And each fish gets its own brine with different seasonings that bring out its flavors. Then Valley puts the fish in the smoker, which he claims is the only licensed 100% wood smoker left in the state.
We light it with wood, it ends with wood. No liquid smoke, no gas, no nothing. And that is huge. It makes a world of difference. Basically, we're all hickory. Once in a while, we'll burn a little apple wood.
And it can't be rushed. Patience is key. Valley could finish the fish in an hour, but he prefers to give it 10 to 12 hours to really soak up the smoky flavor.
I relate it to a sponge. If you just barely hold it on the water, just missed it, it sucks it in and it takes time. So that's what you want to do with the fish. You want to very slowly permeate it and bring it up to temp. You know, otherwise if you just cook it, it's just a cooked piece of fish. It isn't smoked.
1734.
Valley jokes about a law he has at Valley Fish and Cheese when customers make a modest purchase. Once you buy it and leave the door, you can't come back in and buy more.
I will literally, honestly, hear 10 times a day, this is unbelievable smoked fish. Well, it is. Because it was swimming yesterday and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
Yet all that being said, Valley says you don't necessarily need to head over to the Mississippi and catch the fish yourself. He recommends finding a nice piece of salmon or fish of your choice and practicing a little patience.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Mike Valley's smoked fish. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.